In Cato, Minnesota, on the campus of Bethany Lutheran College. I'm Dr. Marvin Meyer, president of Bethany Lutheran College. We are happy to host today's edition of Midday on our campus for this debate between the candidates vying for the United States Senate seat in Minnesota. A warm welcome to those in today's attendance, the citizens of southern Minnesota, students, staff, and professors from Bethany Lutheran College and other area institutions of higher education, and of course the listeners of MPR throughout the state of Minnesota. A special welcome and thank you to the candidates, Mr. Mark Dayton, Mr. James Gibson, Senator Rod Grams, and Mr. David Swan. We are happy to have you here as our guests. Debates have long been a way for both candidates and citizens to voice their opinions. It is our hope that today's proceedings will help those in attendance and those listening on the radio or web to come to a clearer understanding of the individuals that aspire to the role of Senator of the United States, representing the citizens of Minnesota. Bethany Lutheran College is thrilled to welcome Mr. Gary Eichten, the host of Midday, as the moderator for today's debate. Mr. Eichten.
Thanks, Dr. Meyer, and good afternoon. Welcome to Midday and today's U.S. Senate debate featuring the candidates of all four major political parties here in the state of Minnesota. Mankato, of course, is right in the heart of some of the richest, most productive farmland in the world. Mankato is also one of Minnesota's regional economic centers that has generally bucked the trend. While much of rural Minnesota has been struggling, Mankato's economy has been doing fairly well. And so since we are here in Mankato today, we thought we would focus our debate, at least in part, on agriculture and rural development. But, of course, we also hope to touch on several other key issues in the campaign as well. Our format is simple enough. We'll have a question or two for the candidates, and those of you here in the audience will also have a chance to ask your questions. Just get the attention of our two Oprahs, and today they are Tom Rothman, who is Farm Director of the Minnesota Farm Network, and Mark Stile of Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street Radio Unit. Get their attention, and they'll get a microphone to you. Also, because both of them know so much about these issues, we've asked them to ask a question or two along the way. Now, as we said, all four major party candidates are joining us today. Republican incumbent Rod Grams has been temporarily delayed, but he'll be rolling in here any moment. In the meanwhile, we've been joined by the other three major party candidates, Democrat and former state auditor Mark Dayton, software developer James Gibson, the Independence Party candidate, and David Swan, the Constitution Party candidate. He is a computer consultant from Brooklyn Park. And Mr. Swan, you've not received as much media attention as the other candidates, so to begin, why don't you take a minute or two just to give us a better idea of who you are and what the Constitution Party stands for.
Thank you, Gary, and I'd like to thank the college for hosting us today as well. The Constitution Party began in 1992 because we realized that the Republican Party had abandoned the principles that I thought it once held, and it is not a pro-life party. We are 100% pro-life. It is not for local control of education. We are for local control of education. It is not for reducing the size of big government. We are for reducing the size of government and returning it to its constitutional delegated powers, and that's why the name Constitution Party has become the banner of our party. So I think in summary, we are the party that wants to return control of your future to you and return control of your money to you so that you can mark your own course, plot your own dreams, and live them out.
James Gibson, I think some people are kind of confused. What in the world is the Independence Party? Is this Jesse Ventura's Reform Party? Are you the Pat Buchanan Reform Party? What are you? Can you give us a couple of sentences on your party?
Well, the Independence Party has its roots way back in the days of Ross Perot, and at one point we affiliated with the National. We became the Reform Party. We were concerned. There was no other party in the country as strong as this party, and when the presidential ballot was up for grabs, if you will, there was a significant amount of federal election money involved, and the parties in the other states were quite a bit weaker than our party. It was just a natural that the Pat Buchanans of the world would attempt to come in and literally change the character of the party. So what we did was decide to disaffiliate from the National, and we went back, disaffiliate, and we changed our name back to the Independence Party. So we're simply a state party, no connection to the National. The most visible member of our party, of course, is Governor Ventura. And after I'm elected to the Senate, we'll have two visible members. And so it will be less a party associated with a celebrity governor and more a balanced party, if you will.
Mark Dayton, I guess everyone knows who the Democrats are. But there have been critics, especially, the Ralph Nader supporters, for example, suggesting that there's not a dime's worth of difference between you folks and the Republicans. Is there?
Oh, I think there are very major differences, Gary. And, of course, between Senator Graham's and myself in this race, I think the differences are profound. In terms of the presidential race, there are certainly major differences. Vice President Gore has the breadth of experience worldwide and nationally that Governor Bush doesn't have. And I think if Minnesotans and Americans think when they're going into the voting booth that we still live in a very turbulent, uncertain world where anything can happen and probably will during the next 4 years, to me the choice is very clear.
Mm-hmm. But those are. Can you give us, in terms of the party philosophy, is there one significant difference between the two?
I think this administration, which Vice President Gore would continue, deserves enormous credit for bringing this country's budget from deficit into surplus. The employment in this country is growth has been unprecedented under this administration. There are more people working in America today than ever before. The opportunity now with budget surpluses to move ahead to protect Social Security, to provide Medicare coverage of prescription medicines directly as Vice President Gore proposes, as I propose to bring down the cost of prescription medicines, are issues where the Democratic Party has been in the forefront, unfortunately stifled by being in the minority in the Congress, and where Governor Bush has proposals that are essentially more insurance policies. He has an insurance policy for just about every problem we face, but they're not going to address the economic crunch on seniors and other middle-income families.
Okay. Now, again, we should emphasize Senator Grahams will be joining us here momentarily. He got caught in traffic, though. Problem we can all...
I'd be glad to give his response for the Republican Party.
There wouldn't be that much difference.
All right, then. One of the state's best agriculture journalists, Tom Rothman of the Minnesota Farm Network, is with us today. He is serving as one of our Oprahs, but we'd also like to draw on his expertise. Tom, a question for the candidates, please.
Yes, thank you, Gary. Farmers right now are playing under the rules of the 1996 Farm Bill. It's set to expire in 2 years. It's received a lot of criticism. But before 1996, when this bill was written, farm legislation at that time received a lot of criticism. Is it possible for the federal government in this country to write a farm bill that keeps farmers profitable in light of all the supply and demand factors that farmers must deal with on a global scale?
James Gibson, you want to start?
It's very difficult. I've taken the position that the government ought to get out of this business. That is, the whole process of providing subsidies is counterproductive. It prevents the normal market from functioning. What happens, subsidies become capitalized. That is, they get embedded in asset values. So if I were to go out and buy a farm today, I would pay more for that farm than if the subsidies didn't exist. In effect, the person selling the farm reaps the benefit of the subsidies, not the person buying the farm. In the same manner, 2 out of 3 acres in Minnesota are rented, not owned. And those subsidies end up flowing to the landlord because the rental values are higher than they otherwise would be if the subsidies didn't exist. In addition, because of some of the subsidies, we have additional production taking place, additional land in production, some land in production that never would have been put into production had it not been for the existence of these subsidies. In the end, the subsidies distort this market in very negative ways, and they prevent us from generating a market which will work to the benefit of farmers.
Mark Dayton?
Well, Jim, of course, that's what the Republican Congress, Mr. Grahams and others, had in mind in 1996 when they wrote this new farm bill. They were going to get the government out of supporting agriculture, and the market was going to provide for that income and profit, which is exactly the opposite of what occurred. The prices for Minnesota farm commodities have dropped precipitously in the last 3 years. The Congress has, of necessity, been providing emergency assistance, not only supplemental assistance, but in advance of the planting season, but also then two of the last 3 years and this year they did it in advance, retroactive assistance to otherwise farmers would have gone bankrupt throughout Minnesota. So we've had the worst of both worlds. We've had market prices at disastrously low levels for Minnesota farmers, and we've had taxpayer subsidies at record high level for Minnesota taxpayers. The USDA just reported that last year alone, the direct payments from the federal government, meaning American taxpayers, to farmers was $28 billion, and that constituted over half of all farm income in this country. So we definitely have the government has not yet written a perfect farm bill, but they wrote a worse one in '96 from the one before. I don't propose we go back. I propose we go forward, but we've got to get prices back in the marketplace where farmers can make a fair profit. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to survive unlike any other business.
James Gibson, quick comment, and then we'll move.
Yes. I have a whole lot more faith in the market, Mark, than you do, and to attribute the current problem strictly to the farm bill just isn't realistic. We've had worldwide bumper crops, and whether we were on the old farm bill or the new farm bill, you would have seen severe problems in the agriculture community. And there are other things that we could do, but we never get around to doing them because we're so focused on these subsidy programs.
David Swan.
We haven't managed in 65 years to figure out a formula that would work for the federal government to fix the family farm. In fact, one of the reasons that land prices are so high is because the federal land bank has caused them artificially to rise over the years. Farmers are faced with the problem that the cost of their land keeps going up, the cost of their crops keeps going down, and the federal government keeps stepping in and artificially creating a playing field that requires them to be dependent on the government for one-third to one-half of their income. There isn't another industry or business in this country at this point that is so required. I believe, as Mr. Gibson does, that we need to move away from those subsidies, but not just for actuarial reasons or business reasons, but fundamentally because, as you look at the Constitution of this country, the founders did not envision the federal government managing the family farm. They envisioned that if there was help to be provided by any government entity, it would come from the county and the state level. And there is no delegated authority in the Constitution for any of these farm bills that we've had over the last 65 years. And I would ask any of these candidates to point to the place in the Constitution where such legislation and funding is supported by the Constitution. I don't think they can do it.
Republican Rod Grams has joined us now, and traffic cleared up a little bit. Mark Dayton agreed to answer for you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks a lot, Mark. But
question before the House here is there were complaints, a lot of mighty complaints about the farm legislation prior to the Freedom to Farm legislation. Lots of complaints now about post-Freedom to Farm. As a practical matter, can the federal government, is this something that the federal government can actually deal with in an effective way?
Well, first, I apologize for being late. I was over talking to students at Cass and Manorville High School, and they asked a few more questions than I anticipated, so I got a late start. So I apologize for being late getting here. Talking about the Freedom to Farm bill, you know, I have supported the direction that the Freedom to Farm legislation is taking agriculture in the United States today, and I would disagree with Mark and some of the others that I think you'd have to drag farmers kicking and screaming back into the old farm program. The majority of the farmers I talk to across the state of Minnesota, north, south, east, or west, like the direction Freedom to Farm is going, and that is the freedom and flexibility under the programs. Now, there has been some concerns about the safety nets, and a lot of it, even Mr. Glickman, Secretary of Agriculture, said the problems facing agriculture today are not because of Freedom to Farm, but because of the recession that happened out in the Asian countries and other problems, but that we need to move forward in the direction. Mark has said in recently here in visiting southern Minnesota that the only way to save agriculture is to get rid of Freedom to Farm. But I think he would agree that parts of Freedom to Farm are good and we need to keep them and not go back to the old farm programs of the 80s. There were a lot of complaints, a lot of farm failures in the 80s because of that. And I really believe that we're moving in the right direction, but we have to look at ways of making Freedom to Farm even better, not abandoning it at this time.
Okay, James Gibson, quick comment before we move along.
I just want to make the point that there are areas of agriculture that have never been subsidized and do just fine. This has, in many cases, a lot more to do with the kind of political power certain types of farms can bring to bear than it does with national interest.
David Swan.
No one will take the challenge and tell me where in the Constitution such legislation is supported, and I think you'll find that trend continuing as you will listen to the rest of the hour.
Mark Dayton.
I don't favor going back to the old bill. I favor writing a new one next year, which retains the best features of freedom to farm, which are especially the planting flexibility, but which raises loan rates, which caps those rates and deficiency payments to certain levels of production so that larger farmers are not getting the majority of taxpayer subsidies, and which reinstates the farmer held reserve program so that farmers can hold those crops as a matter of market timing.
Rod Grams. And just finally, Gary, you can't set the market by raising the loan rate. The market will react as the market will. But there's ways that maybe we can look at a lot of these issues. And I've put together a real policy task force. I have about 80 members now from all walks of life, cross-sections of Minnesotans that serve on this for me. And that's the best people to go to. Go to the experts, and that is the people dealing with agriculture every day. And we're hoping to come up with some ideas to present before Congress from this task force, because I think Minnesotans and our Minnesota farmers have some good ideas, and we need to listen to them.
Our other Oprah today is Mark Stile, longtime Minnesota Public Radio reporter and one of the main street stays of our Main Street radio unit. Mark, a question for the candidates.
Many nursing homes are having trouble finding enough workers to fill all of their open spots, to the point that sometimes a nursing home may have to leave a room unoccupied and turn people away. Is there a need for federal action on this issue? And if so, what would you like to see done?
Mark Dayton, you're first on this one.
There is a real crisis, and I've visited dozens of nursing homes and senior centers around the state, and nursing home workers are being driven out literally because they're overworked and underpaid, and the nursing home administrators are hamstrung because of two reasons. One, the federal government in 1997, as part of its Budget Balancing Act, reduced the funding significantly, and that funding has not been restored as the need has grown. And secondly, because Minnesota has been severely disadvantaged by the reimbursement formula, which was put into place before either of our two senators were in office, but which has been proven, as anything does that benefits some states to others' disadvantage, to be extremely difficult to break. Minnesota's reimbursement formula is only, on average, 72% of the top states, and I think those states that are being penalized, like Minnesota, need to just literally sit down on the Senate floor and hold things up until that is remedied.
Rod Grams.
Gary, the funding problem has been corrected in this year's budget, where we are restoring a lot of the funding that was taken from Medicare. But that is the biggest problem, I think, out there, is the funding and the dollars needed to retain these workers. And we are seeing some of the hospitals and rural nursing facilities that are, you know, operating, if not in the black or in the red, near the red, and need this type of assistance. So we have worked to redo that and to refund a lot of those cutbacks that were made inadvertently, by the way. But also, as far as the reimbursement, I've worked very closely across party lines with our delegation in Minnesota and with other senators in many of the rural states like Montana, Wyoming, South and North Dakota as well, to bring up this reimbursement, because Minnesotans were getting in some areas of the state $200 a month from Medicare, where if you were in Florida, you were getting $750 a month. Well, under legislation supported by Republicans that I have also supported, we are now being able to raise that to around $500 or $525 a month for areas in Minnesota. Now, we're still not at par with, say, Florida or New Mexico, but we have moved a huge step in the right direction, and we're going to continue to reduce this disparity in the future. But we have worked on it, and I think we've made some good strides, and I said reaching across party lines, working together, and we are being able to, I think, answer some of those questions, concerns dealing with Medicare.
David Swan.
Fascinating. You'll notice that they're all on my left. And Senator Grams, what you're talking about is restoring and refunding and spending and spending and spending. And I think you need to give up the label of being a fiscal conservative. In 1994, the Republicans took over Congress and promised to make government smaller. Federal spending that year was $1.4 trillion. This year, annually, it's $2 trillion this year alone. That's $600 billion more in this year. If you take your $500 per child tax credit and weigh the sum of that against the $600 billion, it's less than 1/1,000th of the money. Now, how can you claim that you're getting the government off the backs of our citizens if you're spending over 1,000 times more than the tax cuts that you're implementing and proclaiming victory for the taxpayer? What we need to do is to roll back the size of government by eliminating these unconstitutional programs, and then a lot of these furloughed federal workers will be able to take those jobs.
James Gibson.
Well, David, I never thought I would meet someone to the right of Senator Grahams.
It's easier than you think.
You know, this is certainly a problem, and I was talking with somebody that lived in a town about 40 miles from Rochester, and their concern was that the wages offered by the Mayo Clinic were beyond what they could pay in this small town, and they were concerned with how they could continue nursing home care there. And it's a problem. You know, I wish I had the solution other than simply throwing money at it. One, I keep asking, you know, every other sector of our economy, we continue to try ways of making people more productive. And I posed that question to one person at a nursing home, and their answer was that, well, that's fine, but we don't have the funding sources to make the investments that would make us allow us to be more productive. So I think I'd like to take a look at it from that angle. Are we, in effect, not providing the capital assets that would allow them ultimately to function more efficiently?
Let's get some questions from the audience. Oh,
could I just
go ahead?
I'd like to answer one thing. This is a question of fairness and equity, because the funds we're talking about here in Medicare are funds that are being deducted from the wages of these individuals. And if Minnesota pays in the same amount as they pay in Florida, why is Minnesota getting less money? And that's what we're working to do, not to create new taxes or to go out there and do anything else, but the monies that are already deducted that are in the program that they have dedicated funds for, we're trying to get equity to make sure that Minnesotans get at least the same share as other parts of the country. And that's what this is about, not raising new taxes or anything else, unless we're going to change the whole concept of Medicare itself. But that's what this question is about.
Tom, audience question?
Gary, we have a question from a student here at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato. Paula Jensen has a question for the candidates on Social Security.
My question is, Social Security was never meant to be a sole means for retirement. It was meant to be a supplement to personal savings and investment. So my question is, in your opinion, what is the best way to deal with Social Security, especially targeting young people such as myself who may be less likely to receive its benefits?
Senator Grahams, you're up first.
Well, thank you very much for that question, because I think Social Security, the question about it today and the future, is so important. First of all, we've got to make sure that people who have worked their whole lives and are now on Social Security or about to retire will make sure that they get those benefits they've been promised, just like George W. Bush is talking about, to guarantee those benefits. But also at the same time, when we're looking at you, the younger generation, we've got to make sure we give you investment opportunities for your retirement that are going to provide more dollars for your retirement, not the meager check that others want to tie you to, like Mark Dayton does and like Al Gore does. They want to tie you to a system that is run by the government rather than giving you freedoms and opportunities to have a better retirement. And under the plan that I proposed, much like what Governor Bush has proposed, to take some or all of your retirement dollars and be able to choose how you invest those in very safe, sound investments that will make your retirement four, five, six times better than what you can expect to get under Social Security. So bottom line is, how do we make sure we guarantee benefits for those on Social Security today or will retire on Social Security, but at the same time to give our children and our grandchildren an opportunity to have even a better retirement system? And that's what our plan is all about. And we can't allow the government to continue to dictate a small, meager government check and expect you to be satisfied with that.
David Swan.
Not only do we have no constitutional authority for a program like Social Security, but as Senator Grahams has pointed out, we have a system that is virtually bankrupt now. Regardless of what Mark Dayton says, there's no lucid way that you can forecast the survival of Social Security as it exists today. I would differ from Senator Grahams in this regard, that I would favor ending the program entirely. As he has pointed out, we need to protect the people who have been trapped in a system that should never have existed in the first place. There's a moral responsibility for the government to take care of those people and guarantee what they have. But I would go farther than Senator Grahams. I would completely privatize it, not just do some of it, and I would remove all federal control. He wants to keep Social Security and simply give people an option of getting out of it if they want to. A lot of people, when faced with the option of letting the government make the decisions for them, are going to opt for that. That's a reduction in their liberty. That's a reduction in their ability to chart their own course and plan their own future. And I would go all the way and completely privatize it while protecting the people who've been trapped in the system.
James Gibson.
Well, the theme of my campaign is all about justice between generations, and I don't think the existing system is just. I don't think it's just intergenerationally. I don't think it's just from a social standpoint. What we have is a system that is mostly a pay-as-you-go system. We take deductions from your paycheck, and we transfer it to existing retirees. Now, I don't have any problem as a fiscal conservative saying we need to take a portion of a person's paycheck, even a person working a minimum wage, and transfer it into their own account for their own savings. But I have a real problem with taking that same deduction and transferring it to an existing retiree. It's not socially just. The system needs to change. What I advocate is taking this $9 trillion unfunded liability. That's the shortfall that exists in the current system, the money we would have there if we impose the same kind of standards on the Social Security system that we impose on business. Take that $9 trillion of liability. It's an implicit liability now. Book it as explicit debt and begin discharging it through normal tax revenues. We now have a financially and actuarially sound Social Security system. For anyone 55 and younger, we can set up individual accounts. Deductions from your paycheck flow in right into your accounts. You control the investments within certain standards. You'll get a much better return, obviously. And we'll start dealing with this debt through general tax revenues, not payroll taxes.
Mark Dayton.
I think your question shows a really astute understanding of the original intent of Social Security, which was one of the pillars of retirement income and personal savings, personal investments, IRAs, 401ks, individual investments, and what used to be prevalent, now unfortunately declining, private pensions, so that would be the four cornerstones. I'm concerned, however, and not surprised, but concerned when you say, though, that your anticipation is that Social Security won't be there for you when you retire. And I think that's the tragedy of this whole debate, that seniors who are now dependent on Social Security are worried that it's going to collapse, and those who are working or about to enter the workforce believe it won't be there for them. The mid-range, don't take my word for it, consult the Social Security Trust Fund actuaries and trustees, and under their mid-range economic forecasts, the fund will meet all projected benefits till the year 2037. If the economy performs better than that, still, I think, pessimistic assumption, the fund will continue to be in surplus thereafter. But the real question is, what do we do in an alternative? And that's where, Senator, I think your comment that if your proposal is adopted, if workers take up to 80% of their funds out of the system and put it into private investments, that they will make your retirement four, five, six times better, really misstates the reality of the markets, which are not going to provide anybody with a guarantee. You might come out ahead, you might come out worse. The volatility of the market is such that people gain and people lose, and that's where you need to be considered. You want your retirement income to come out of the security that is provided by the United States government and its solvency, or do you want to ride the roller coaster that private investments entail?
Rod Grams.
Well, Gary, I think this shows again that Mark is really out of touch and doesn't understand the reality of the problems facing Social Security. Even Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve, says it is heading towards bankruptcy. The Social Security Administration trustees themselves, in their last report, said that if we do nothing with Social Security, by the year 2030, it'll only be able to pay 70% of the benefits that are being paid today. So the biggest risk with Social Security is to do nothing at all. And by the way, there are 5 million Americans today that already have private retirement accounts because they work for some federal, state, or local governments, and they had the option not to go into Social Security but private accounts. And each one of these pay 3 to 6 times more than Social Security. And I'll bet you that not one of them would trade their private retirement account for a Social Security account. Mark Dayton wants to mandate that you have no choice and that you stay with Social Security. I'm saying that we need to give you the option, and I think you would choose a better future for your Social Security.
I know I want to call on you, but let's get a response. What about the people who already have had an opportunity to choose, and Rod Graham says if they had to choose again, they wouldn't go back to Social Security. They're real happy with this private arrangement.
If we were to set up a national retirement fund today, would we set it up as Social Security was established 65 years ago? Perhaps not. But the reality is that we have that system today where the working generation pays for the generation retired, and then that rolls forward. If you want to move from that to one where each generation invests in order to pay for its own retirement, then either the generation now retired has to be cut short or the generation now working has to pay twice, and that's the problem we're in. The question, first of all, assumes that Social Security is providing some meager retirement. If you're 25 years old today and you earn $20,000 a year, according to the Social Security actuary, if you just continue in the workforce at the projected rate of growth in your income, you'll retire with an income of $54,000 a year from Social Security. Do you need other forms of income? Absolutely. But to say again that if you take 80% of those dollars out, first of all, by your own acknowledgement, Senator, the system would require some $13.5 trillion to make this transition, and that's under an optimistic economic forecast. And secondly, to assume then that you're going to get a 7% return, which is the figure you use as though it's guaranteed like a passbook savings account, is fundamentally misleading. All you need to do is look at the performance of the U.S. stock market over the last 100 years and see that it's gone up and it's gone down, and there have been 20-year periods of time where the net growth has been zero. So you take that risk.
James Gibson.
Well, first off, I've heard you mention this 2030 date twice, Senator. It's 2037, and then from that point forward, we'll be able to pay 72% of benefits. I agree with you, Mark. This system is not in crisis. But on the other hand, I think we have to take very seriously these intermediate estimates that are put out by the Social Security system, the actuaries. I don't think we, as politicians, should be saying these numbers are too conservative. If anything, we should be abiding by a principle in business that you hope for the best, but you prepare for the worst, which means we'd be looking at the worst-case scenario and making sure we're covered in that scenario. Hopefully, things will turn out better than that. That's great. We'll leave it at that.
David Swan.
My apologies to my accounting friends, but I do not want bean counters planning my future. My talk about the Constitution is not just a clever gimmick, people. My talk about the Constitution is based on the fact that our country was founded on the belief that you, as a creature created by God, have certain rights, and that government's job is to protect and secure your rights. Government's job is not to guarantee your happiness. This is about your liberty. This is about your children's liberty. This is about your freedom to be self-determining and make your own choices. It's fascinating to me to watch these guys juggle numbers that I'm sure most of us in this audience don't even understand, when the core issue they're completely ignoring, and that is that this government's job is to make you free and able to choose your own course and get out of the way. You can decide better than anybody sitting on this platform how you should invest your own money. That's why we need to end Social Security, while we protect the people who've been trapped in an unconstitutional system.
All right, just a quick comment here, and I want to get to some other questions because we're, believe it or not, we're already running out of time. James Gibson.
David, this is about being realistic. I don't want people getting to retirement and not having money there, because we'll have to step in as a society and pay welfare. And I don't want to be responsible for that. Much better that we require them to start saving now.
So you want to pay them now instead of pay them later. I want them to pay themselves.
And that's my plan. That's my plan. Give you the opportunity to save.
Well, actually, Senator, it's not really your plan, because you are going to require that they invest it in certain funds that the government approves of, and you're going to require...
No government approval, Dave. Don't say that. This is allowing them to invest in annuities and stocks.
Well, then you'll have to remove that from your website,
No,
Senator.
It's not in there. It's not government-approved investment.
Mark, have you got an audience question down here, please?
Thank you, Gary. Yeah, I have with me a Tom McLaughlin from Mankato, who has a question about the men and women who serve in our armed forces.
Yeah, my question basically is, it's a two-part question, but it's pretty simple. What would the candidates do to see that our current military, the young men and women who serve, get a livable wage so they don't have to rely on food stamps? And in light of the USS Cole, where we lost the 17 young men and women, when they get out of the military, they're going to go into a VA system, which they'll join 27 million other veterans. And talking before about the inadequacies of the nursing homes, I'm sure you've been to the VA hospitals. But the two questions are the funding for the active duty and funding for the Veterans Administration.
David Swan.
Well, it's no secret that our Democratic King now has proclaimed that he's reduced the federal roles and reduced the number of people working for the federal government, but he hasn't mentioned that he's done it by slashing the military. I think it's very disingenuous of him to claim credit for something that's actually to our detriment as a country. I am in favor of a strong national defense. I am in favor of fully funding our military and returning it to a state of readiness where we are able to defend ourselves on two fronts at the same time, unlike the Democratic administration that wants to strip the military of its power and make us vulnerable. I believe also that we need to honor those who've served in any capacity in the military because they have taken an oath to protect our liberty. And I believe we need to do what we have to do in the federal government to fund the resources for them. My father goes to a VA clinic all the time. He was a veteran in World War II. And I also believe that we must keep reducing the size of government. Here we go again, guys. But keep the military funding. And we can reduce all the unconstitutional programs that we have and still fund the federal government with a system of tariffs and an excise tax on non-essential goods and services and keep a strong military and return three-fourths of the money that's now being squandered by the federal government to you, the citizens, and let you decide what to do with it.
Okay. James Gibson, sharp increases in military wages and VA appropriations?
Well, I'm relieved, David, that we finally found something you do think is constitutional.
Jim, you're starting to get the message. That's good.
You know, I've heard from a number of veterans over the last year and a half that they don't feel that we've lived up to our commitments to them. That bothers me, that somehow we've balanced the budget without honoring past liabilities. It's sort of a false balancing of the budget. So I want to look at that very closely. I have to admit that's a very difficult question for me to answer, and I've answered this way pretty much whenever we talk about the military budget. Is it large enough or not large enough? I don't know. Very hard to judge from the outside. But I do want to get there and look at every item on a detailed basis, make sure that the expenditures are being done for strategic reasons and not for political reasons. We've seen small examples where decisions have been made politically, and that bothers me a great deal.
Mark Dayton.
I strongly support a livable wage for everyone who's working, and that would certainly begin with our military, where our young men and women are putting their lives on the line on our behalf. And I think it's disgraceful, the stories I've heard anecdotally, that those men and women and their families are living in substandard housing. And it's been brought up a couple of times by military personnel who are on leave at a couple of our debates, and I've promised that if I'm elected a senator, I'll go tour some of that housing to see. But absolutely, the wages should be such that we attract and retain the best and the brightest of our young men and women into the military, and that they can take care of their families and have the financial benefits commensurate with the risks they're assuming on our behalf. And in terms of the VA hospitals, this is another area where the 1997 Balanced Budget Act really cut back drastically, has curtailed the services. We've made a promise to our veterans who served us with courage and distinction, and it's not keeping that promise if they have to wait 6 months to get an appointment or have to drive over 200 miles to get to a VA facility. So, yes, we need to restore those cuts and restore our promise.
Rod Grams.
Well, Mark, it's the Clinton administration that has basically gutted the military over the last 8 years, and it's the Democratic platform that you support that would offer even more cuts and more reductions in our military in the years ahead. And we're at the lowest level of readiness now since Jimmy Carter was president. And Al Gore gets up and says reinventing government is at smallest level since John Kennedy. But the reason he can say that, which is a distortion, is because he's including the 300,000 plus men and women that he has taken out of the military and the dollars he's taken out with it. George W. Bush and I agree on this, and that is that we need a strong military. We need a military that we don't have servicemen and women that are getting food stamps in order to survive, where our men and women are using equipment or flying airplanes that are older than they are. We need to make sure that we can invest. And I know Governor Bush was kind of ridiculed by this administration when he says that we are not prepared to meet a challenge or two challenges or on two fronts if necessary. The truth is we could probably meet those challenges, but we have gutted everything behind that to sustain or support that. And we need to have a strong military to do that. And I have voted, in other words, to make sure that when we send our young men and women out there to protect this country, that we give them every means of success and every means of coming back home safely.
James Gibson.
Well, Senator, you say you're for expanded military spending, but in all of your public statements, you have indicated that you don't want any additional public spending. You reserve of this $1.8 trillion surplus, you said $900 billion is for a tax cut and $900 billion for a national debt pay down. So I'm not quite sure what exactly you're proposing here.
Rod Grams?
Well, I can put that into the budget, but I mean, we're talking here about a baseline budget that brings the military up. And I also agree that we need to have some savings under the Pentagon. And we need to make the Pentagon accountable. But at the same time, Jim, we have to make sure that we provide the resources, and we have taken those first steps in this budget for fiscal year 2002. And we're going to continue moving in that direction with missile defense programs and other things that are already calculated in that budget increases.
Mark Gayton?
I would, similar question, Senator, if you've been this concerned about the declining salaries for military, could you cite the Graham's amendments the last few years that have raised the appropriations for that purpose? And I would secondly point out that your legislation, which you've introduced for Social Security, your privatization proposal, in the law would require, not suggest, but require that all spending be cut at 5% below the current year level and then frozen for 10 years, which means military, veteran services, and the like would all be cut 5% initially, and by the end of those 10 years would be an effective cut of 25%, which underscores, again, how impossible it is to make a transition in the way you're talking.
Gary, I can just easily point to every vote that I've taken in strong support of our military and increasing the pay and increasing the readiness and the missile defense in the future. Now, I can't say that for all my Democratic colleagues and this administration that have followed that as well. They say and they talk a good game, but they do not provide our servicemen and women with what they need to do the job we're asking them to do.
Just a quick yes and no answer on a kind of military-related question. The presidential candidates, Bush and Gore, are lobbing grenades at each other over whether or not peacekeeping troops should be kept in the Balkans or whether they should be brought home. Would you support keeping U.S. troops as peacekeepers in the Balkans for the next few years? James Gibson?
Yes.
Mark Dayton?
Yes, under U.S. authority.
Rod Grams?
Yes, with a qualifying, you know, they were supposed to be brought home 2 years ago, and we can't give them an endless time in which we're going to commit our men and women there.
David Swan?
No, absolutely not. They need to come home now. They're not under our authority when they're under U.N. authority.
Not a lot of time left, but if you're just joining us, we're broadcasting live from the Ilva Sacher Fine Arts Center on the campus of Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato. I'm Gary Eichen. The four major party candidates for the U.S. Senate have joined us. And we'd like to remind you that today's debate is co-sponsored by Minnesota Public Radio and Bethany Lutheran College. Also, check out our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. Lots more information about the candidates and the issues, including that ever-popular Select a Candidate feature. You punch in your position on the issues, the computer twirls around and matches you up with the candidate of your choice. It's a nice, warm relationship that you can form. Tom, you got another audience question here?
Yes, Gary, from another student here at Bethany Lutheran. John Schmidt has a question for the candidates about the Middle East.
Yes, due to the current situation in regards to Israel and Palestine, to what extent do you believe the U.S. should be involved? And if war should break out, would you support the use of U.S. ground forces in that area?
Mark Dayton?
Well, first, I think, apropos of your last comment, Gary, we should commend NPR for initiating the first computer political dating service in America.
We do what we can, you know.
The response, we have a vital stake in the Middle East. We have a vital stake because it's one of the points on the planet where a major conflagration, which could erupt into a worldwide war, could most likely occur. This administration, President Clinton, has, I think, been terrific and heroic in his efforts to mediate a peace, a lasting peace there, which is the only solution for the different nationalities and views and religions which are trying to coexist there. Only if Israel's security is absolutely assured, only if its neighbors acknowledge that and agree that they will not try to come and use religious holidays and the like to drive that country out of existence or to conduct terrorist activities, only then will there be a chance for lasting peace, and that's what the United States should be promoting. If there is an attack, the Israeli armed forces has shown itself to be extremely capable to defending itself. It's on constant preparedness. Having been there, you have no idea what it's like to be surrounded just a few miles away by your forsworn enemies. I would not, under any conceivable circumstance right now, favor putting U.S. troops in there because I don't think they would be needed. I want the U.S. foreign policy to be one of trying to negotiate a lasting peace there.
If they are needed, 1973, there was talk of U.S. Military intervention.
Given the mobilization the timetable here and given this country, as I say, I mean, we're talking about the ability of an F-15 fighter plane to fly the width of that country in 30 seconds. So given the reality, and the Israelis know this, they need our financial support, they need our military assistance, and that should be continued. But the reality is they know that they have to defend themselves because only they can defend themselves. So that should be our line of approach.
Rod Grams?
I think the United States' role has been exactly what we've tried to do, and that is promote an environment where these peace talks can take place. And we should, and we have been encouraging both sides to come to the table and to try work out their differences. What we cannot do, in my opinion, is try to impose any kind of terms or conditions on this peace agreement or a peace settlement, because it's between the Palestinians and the Israelis that need to work this out to come up with a plan or an idea that both of them can live with. So I hope that we can continue down that path, and we thought there was some progress being made recently. But as you know, the escalating violence and the renewed violence in the Middle East means these talks have not been fruitful or successful. But I would not at this time support putting U.S. troops on the ground. But, you know, in the future, does it put U.S. national security or interests at risk? You might have to reassess it. But right now, I would not support using U.S. ground forces in any way in the Middle East at this time.
David Swan.
The Constitution is a marvelous document. It even speaks to this situation. And this is not a joke, people. This is real. Constitution means constituted. Our government exists today because of that document. We need to go back to it because it offers us a blueprint for how we're supposed to conduct ourselves. There is no legitimate role for U.S. ground troops in that setting unless our national interests are threatened. I don't believe that that is really going to happen. It's really awkward because we're funding through foreign aid both sides of this equation. The fundamental problems in that area are not political, they are moral and spiritual. I would never send a perjurer to mediate any dispute. I believe that we have shown ourselves to be the friend of Israel, and I believe that I would take a new approach, and I would send someone who would be a neutral party in these negotiations. Benjamin Netanyahu recently said, Yasser Arafat doesn't want peace with Israel. He wants peace without Israel. And I believe that that is the intention of Mr. Arafat. And until these people on both sides, and I'd say the Israelis have done a better job of it so far, until these people can understand and learn the spiritual discipline of forgiveness, there will never be peace in that nation, no matter how much political negotiations are undertaken. And I believe that's where the efforts need to be focused. I think we need to send people into that negotiations who are men and women of prayer, who are deeply spiritual, and who can call out the best in both sides and see if that spirit of forgiveness can be brought forth.
James Gibson.
It would be nice if we could impose a solution, but unfortunately we can't. The best role we can play is that of facilitator, just encouraging the parties to sit down and talk and find common ground. I can't envision either, Mark, a situation where Israel couldn't defend itself. The next step for us would be simply providing more military aid if their security was threatened.
Another one of those unfair yes and no questions, but that's about all we have time for here. Governor Ventura, of course, down in Mexico, trying to promote more trade between Minnesota and Mexico. Are NAFTA-type agreements, trade agreements, good for the state of Minnesota? Rod Grams?
Yes, I strongly supported them when they were in Congress, worked for their passage, Gary, and like George W. Bush is talking about expanding free trade. I supported PNTR, Permanent Normalized Trade Relations with China. I would also support expanding NAFTA to the rest of the Western Hemisphere as well.
David Swan?
No, and Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China was a moral mistake. I believe we should rescind it. I don't think it was in the best interest of those human beings who are being persecuted in China, and to go along to get along with the Chinese will always result in them getting what they want and us not getting what we want.
James Gibson?
These are yes or no questions, right?
Basically.
Yes.
Okay. And Mark Dayton, NAFTA-type agreements good for Minnesota?
In balance, no. I support Governor Ventura's efforts to increase exports, which is always the sell for these, but in balance, the Minnesota farmers and workers have been hurt.
Okay. To conclude, we'd like to give each of the candidates 2 minutes for a closing statement, and might as well start at that end, work our way around. Constitution Party candidate David Swan. Mr. Swan?
Thank you, Gary, for hosting us and moderating today. If you look up here and you see four distinct candidates with four distinct sets of ideas, I think you need to look again. The Constitution Party is the only 100% pro-life party that's sitting on this platform today. Senator Grams in H.R. 3019, 2264, and 2606 has voted for international family planning and UN population control funds. He is not a principled pro-life candidate, nor is the Republican Party a principled pro-life party. They run and hide from the pro-life issue whenever they can, and when they're forced to say something about it, they usually focus on partial birth abortion rather than ending abortion. We have a presidential candidate who has a plan to end abortion based on the evidence, based on the plain language of the Constitution. The only party that's going to provide leadership in ending abortion is the Constitution Party. We have a plan for ending the federal role in education. Senator Grams wants to continue the federal role in education. Last night he said that he didn't support School to Work and Goals 2000. But again, in two of those same bills, he's supported $1.2 billion of funding for Goals 2000 and School to Work. He does not want to end the Department of Education, neither does George Bush. They want to continue the federal role in education. There is no valid or pragmatically useful role for the federal government to be involved in education at all. We are the only party that will support an end to the federal role in education and provide leadership in that area. Fundamentally, if you want to drive this country over the cliff of socialism at 100 miles an hour, you should vote for Mark Dayton. If you want it to go over the cliff at the speed limit, you should vote for Rod Grams. If you want it to go over somewhere in between, vote for James Gibson. But if you want to reverse the direction of this country and return us to limited government, you need to vote for David Swan and the Constitution Party. Thank you.
Okay, that was Constitution Party candidate David Swan. And next up, Republican Party candidate Rod Grams.
Well, thank you, Gary, and thanks also to NPR and also Bethany Lutheran College for providing this forum for this debate. I was elected back in 1994 on a platform of hard work and responsibility of tax relief for families and a government that would provide better services in a more efficient way, a better future where government works for us, not bigger government that demands more from us. Now, I realize there also is a good amount of apathy among Minnesota voters because I think they hear a lot from candidates that promise them they're going to give them everything and give it to them for nothing. In other words, trying to bribe us with our own money, because that's where these dollars are going to come from. Someone always pays the bills for these new promises, and that someone is you. You work hard for your money. The government shouldn't be able to take more and more of it just to pay for campaign promises. Now, during my 8 years in Congress, I have worked hard to keep the promises that I made and provide a strong voice for our Minnesota families. I promised to cut taxes, and I have. The Graham's $500 per child tax credit provides $500 million a year in tax relief to Minnesota families. I'm working to double that, to eliminate the marriage penalty, to get rid of the unmoral, unfair death tax. I promised I would work to protect and guarantee retirement benefits for today's seniors, and the Graham's lockbox does that. I'm also working to give better retirement investment opportunities for you, our children and grandchildren. I have worked to make health care more accessible and affordable, making premiums 100% deductible, creating medical savings accounts to strengthen and preserve Medicare, and I've worked for 3 years to provide a Medicare prescription drug package for our seniors who need it. Now, I've worked to keep the promises I have made and to meet the needs of our families for better schools, for our seniors, our farmers, our business community, and to use common sense and sound science to protect our environment and resources. And I've worked across party lines to get things done because it's people, not the party, that counts. I need to go back to Washington to finish the work for you. I ask for your help and support, and I ask for your vote on November 7th. Thank you.
That was Republican Rod Grams, and next up is a DFL party candidate, Mark Dayton. Mr. Dayton?
Gary, thank you, and thank you to NPR and to Bethany Lutheran College for hosting this event. I think it's been commendable and unusual for its civility and focus on issues here, and I thank you for that. I wish I could be that sanguine about the next 2+ weeks that remain, because having read in Saturday paper that Senator Graham's campaign manager said that his campaign was going to be spending this remaining time showing Minnesotans how, and this is the word, quote, despicable, close quote, I am. I'm not that hopeful. The Republican Party of Minnesota last week sent out a mailing to 100,000 Minnesotans, a brochure that said on the front of it, meet Minnesota's number one drug lord, a picture of me, Mark Dayton. Twice last Friday, Senator, one of your senior campaign aides taunted my 23-year-old driver with the saying, drug lord, drug lord, drug lord, in the morning and in the evening. This young woman just graduated 3 months ago from Mankato State University, and I think it's an awful way for her to be introduced to Minnesota politics. So I would call on you again, Senator, as I said last night, to agree that we will conduct these last 2+ weeks, and I would include my other opponents as well, with the kind of positive focus on issues that Minnesotans deserve, where you present your positions on issues, I present mine. My television and other advertising would do that. Yours would do the same. We could make the contrasts between us, which are real, very apparent to Minnesotans, and then on November 7th, they could make their decision. I think that's the kind of campaign that would best serve this state.
That was DFL party candidate Mark Dayton. And finally, Independence Party candidate James Gibson. Mr. Gibson.
I want to thank you, David, for placing me somewhere in the middle of Senator Graham's and Mark Dayton. You know, I do see these ads go back and forth, and I think they're very counterproductive. They no doubt benefit my campaign, so from that standpoint, I'm thankful that you're wasting your resources in such a manner. I want to leave you with a sense of my concern for the future, because I'm really in this race because of your generation. I feel it's incumbent upon my generation and my folks' generation to take this window of opportunity of 12 to 15 years and start preparing for it, because when my generation starts retiring, it's going to place a huge burden on your generation. And it's very easy for my generation not to take that responsibility seriously. Senator Grahams and Mark Dayton effectively are both buying your votes in one way or another. Senator Grahams by reducing taxes, Mark Dayton by expanding federal government. I will contend that the biggest issue and the biggest concern that you should have is these liabilities that are sitting out there, the national debt, the unfunded liabilities in the Social Security system and other pension programs. I can easily make the case that each one of you, as you become an adult, will incur a $100,000 liability. And this will affect you all the rest of your life. It's imperative that we begin dealing with this. It's imperative that my generation be willing to sacrifice something today to create a better world the next day and the next day and the next year and 5 years down the road and 10 years down the road. And we can do it if we have the political will and the maturity and the courage to do that. And I ask for your support.
That was Independence Party candidate James Gibson. And we're out of time. Thanks so much to all four candidates, David Swan, Rod Grahams, Mark Dayton, and James Gibson. Thanks to all of you here at Bethany for turning out. Thanks to those of you who've been listening on the radio. And, of course, thanks so much to Dr. Marvin Meyer and all of you here at Bethany Lutheran for hosting and co-sponsoring today's debate. We'll be rebroadcasting this debate at 9 tonight on Minnesota Public Radio. Second chance to hear it. And don't forget to check our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. Sarah Meyer is the producer of our debate coverage. Our engineer today here at Bethany was Scott Liebers. The Public Affairs Department of Minnesota Public Radio, headed by Will Hadland, organized today's debate. Oprah's Today, Tom Rothman, Farm Director of the Minnesota Farm Network, Mark Stile of Minnesota Public Radio.